tonight. Welcome. Tonight's Zen story is case 16 in the Book of Serenity. It's a juicy story, seems to me. May you find it so as well. It's also case 31 in the Blue Cliff Record, but we'll look at the Book of Serenity. One of the classic Chinese Zen stories called Ma Gu Shakes His Staff. The introduction to get us in the mood for this story. Partly these introductions get us in the mood by using all these strange images and words. So this is Zen style of getting us in the mood. Pointing to a deer, making it out to be a horse. Picking up earth and turning it to gold. Rousing wind and thunder on the tongue. Hiding a bloody sword between the eyebrows. Sitting there, watching success and failure, standing there, examining death and life. Tell me, what state is this? Do you feel in the mood now? Just a few points about this introduction. Pointing to a deer, making it out to be a horse. Implies language is very flexible. It's okay to actually point at a deer and call it a horse. We're allowed to do that. And somebody might have a problem with that, right? And say, you can't do that. It's a horse and you have to call it a horse. But these Zen ancestors could do things like point to a deer and call it a horse. And partly to see if anyone would be disturbed by saying something like that, which is kind of what this story is about, is getting the potential for getting disturbed around words. Picking up earth and turning it into gold, similar idea. You can just pick up some ordinary earth and call it gold. Make it gold with your mind. Well, let's leave it at that for this introduction. The case itself is about Magu, who is was a student of Matsu. And you may know Magu as the one who fanned himself at the end of the Genjo Koan. We sometimes say Mayu, Master Baoche of Mount Mayu, just kept fanning himself. When asked how to practice. So this is in his earlier days when he's on pilgrimage and visiting different teachers. And it seems to imply that he's has some understanding of how things are. He's quite confident, and he wants to like check this out with some teachers, which was part of the Zen style in the old days and sometimes in new days. Seeking approval. This is the juicy part, I think, because isn't that a big issue for all of us? Seeking approval. Caring what others think and feeling dejected when we're criticized and elated when we're praised. So maybe Magu knows that this is a difficult and dangerous area to go meet a Zen teacher and kind of like check himself out. We don't know if he was actually looking for approval or not, but maybe. The story goes like this. Magu, with his ringed staff in hand, so the monks would often travel with a staff with jingling rings on the end to warn the little critters that they were coming, so they could hear the sound and they wouldn't step on small creatures. Is one reason why they had these jingling rings. Well, it was just kind of a Zen walking staff. Now, Magu, with his ringed staff in hand, came to Zhang Jing. He circled the meditation seat three times, shook his staff once, and stood there at attention. Maybe it was a Dharma talk, maybe it was like Dokusan, but Zhang Jing was sitting on the seat. Magu came in to meet him, walked three times around, which is, you can sometimes find in the old sutras, when people came to meet the Buddha, they'd circumambulate him like that out of respect. And so sometimes Zen people did that too. Walked around three times and stood there at attention. Zhang Jing said, "Right, right, correct." And it doesn't say exactly what happened next, but maybe he just left. Or maybe he stayed a while and they had further conversations. But later, Magu went to Nanchuan and did the same thing. Circled his meditation seat three times, shook his staff, and stood there at attention. And Nanchuan said, "Wrong, wrong, incorrect." And at this point, Magu said, "Well, Zhang Jing, on the last mountain I visited, said right. Why do you say wrong?" Nanchuan said, "Well, Zhang Jing is right. It's you who's wrong. This is something that can be blown by the power of the wind. It inevitably disintegrates." Or, "This is something that can be whirled about in the wind and eventually breaks down and disintegrates." That's the story about right and wrong, and meeting, and approval and disapproval. So this issue of right and wrong is a big one, and we have the area of kind of like ethical right and wrong, like harming others and not harming others. So that's one whole area that actually this story is not really about that, right? This is maybe a more subtle kind of right and wrong. It's not ethically right or wrong to walk around the seat, shake the staff, and stand there, right? But there's something in this way of expressing himself, this Zen kind of bringing oneself forward and expressing oneself, that could be assessed by another as right or wrong. Like, this expression is authentic or not. I mean, all the things that right and wrong can imply. It's a big matter for all of us, I think. Even if people don't say, "You're right" or "You're wrong," we feel these kind of judgments and make these kind of judgments throughout the day. Every day, in small ways and large. But going back to the introduction, pointing to a deer and making it out to be a horse, this is the flexibility of words. So these words, right and wrong, or correct and incorrect, are very very powerful words, right, that easily like shake us up. But that's what they are. They're words. So Magu is maybe part of what he was doing was testing himself to see if he could not be like thrown around by these words of approval or disapproval. In the commentary, it says one of the commentators in the old days in China said, "Right can affirm nothing. Wrong contains no real denial. Right and wrong have no master. Myriad virtues are ultimately one. The owl and the chickens, for no reason, naturally separate by day and by night." So, right and wrong have no master. There's no, like, great judge being who's determining this right and wrong. Their words and mental imputations that arise in the moment according to the particular situation with the particular people, there's no essence behind them. There's no master who is putting them forth. Right and wrong have no master, I think is a great statement when we're caught up in right and wrong. And the owl and the chickens, for no reason, naturally separate by day and by night. In other words, chickens, you know, are active in the daytime. Some of them crow at dawn and greet the day, and they go do their thing in the day, and owls do their thing at night. So we might say, well, we can explain the reasons why, but this commentary says they separate into day and night for no reason. It's just a natural occurrence. And a little commentary on right and wrong. We could say separate into right and wrong just naturally for no particular reason, if we look at it from a really wide point of view. Again, we can explain why this is right and that's wrong, and we're very good at that. That's what we usually do. But ultimately, they have no master. And then there's this issue of going to seek approval from a teacher or from anyone. So one time, doesn't show up in this main story, but the commentary mentions another time that Magu goes to visit another teacher. He went to national teacher Hui Zhong's place, again walked around the seat three times, shook his staff, and stood there. The national teacher said, "Well, since you're capable of such as this, what further need is there to see me?" In other words, this is like a very confident and straightforward expression of your Zen to just present yourself like that. So, you know, why are you coming to ask me about it? Magu shook his staff again with this national teacher, and the national teacher said, "You wild fox ghost, get out of here." So, maybe he wasn't ready for that question. And just like, well, I'll just shake it again. somehow in that meeting, this Hui Zhong felt like he pushed on Magu's confidence a little bit, and maybe he felt like Magu kind of wavered a little. Maybe he could have just walked out and say, "You're right, what need is there?" But this is a very tricky thing, this, you know, checking what need is there. So it's partly about this issue of right and wrong, approval and disapproval, but it's also about doing this in the particular situation of Zen practice. This story of Magu was following several centuries after another story very similar to this that Magu probably knew about because it was well known in the Zen halls of those days. You might even have heard this story too, and if not, now you will know it. It's a story about the sixth ancestor, one of the great Chinese Zen ancestors, which is one of our Zen ancestors. And it's a student of him meeting someone named Yong Jia, who's also called the Overnight Guest. Have you heard about him? He wrote this poem called The Song of Realization. Actually, literally, the name is something like The Song of Verifying the Way, or Approval of the Way. So his famous poem even has this issue about verification, confirmation, approval in the very title. Yong Jia had studied the sutras for many years. This was just the beginning of the Zen tradition in China. Zen is like this separate transmission outside the sutras, but many people were studying sutras in China from centuries before this. So one time he discovered the ground of mind as he read the Vimalakirti Sutra. I think some of you are reading the Vimalakirti Sutra. So you may discover the ground of mind if you read it without trying to discover the ground of mind. So one day he ran into another Zen monk and they had discussion, and this monk said, the words you say are very much in accord with the way of Zen. And so where did you get this understanding? And Yong Jia said, I heard these sutras and treatises and later realized the source of Buddhahood from the Vimalakirti Sutra. As yet, there has been no one to corroborate it or to approve of it. And this Zen monk he was talking with said, before the prehistoric Buddhas, or before the seven ancient Buddhas, you've gotten that part. But self-confirmation without a teacher after the seven ancient Buddhas is all naturalistic deviation. In other words, in the realm of the Buddhas and ancestors, or the Zen ancestors after these ancient Buddhas, the self-confirmation or the self-approval without meeting with a teacher is naturalistic deviation, or kind of like sometimes they talk about original enlightenment or spontaneous enlightenment, and in the Zen tradition it's somewhat criticized as like you have to you can't do this on your own, basically. Even if you deeply understand something on your own, the full fruition of this understanding happens in a meeting with others. Otherwise, it's like we have this term pratyeka Buddhas, which are like these solitary Buddhas that have deep realization on their own, but they're just kind of lost in the bushes. And so then Yong Jia said, well, will you please be my witness? Will you please approve me? And he said, well, my word carries no weight, but in Cao Chi, there's the sixth ancestor of Zen, and if you go there, I'll go with you. So he did. Yongjia went to the sixth ancestor at Saoji. He circled Huineng three times, shook his ringed staff, and stood there. Maybe he was the first Zen person to do that, that Magu later copied. And Huineng, when he did this, instead of saying right or wrong, he said, a monk embodies 3,000 dignified manners and 80,000 refinements of behavior. Where do you come from, great worthy one, to be so conceited as to just show up and stand there like that without doing any bows or anything, you know, the formalities when you go to meet a teacher in those days? Where are you coming from? Isn't that a little bit arrogant of you to just present yourself like that? And Yongjia said, birth and death is the great matter. Impermanence is swift. And maybe because he said that, that's what we have written on the han, we call the board that's hanging outside there, that keeps time for, in Zen retreats, it's a timekeeping device. So when the one striking it is keeping time, they can remember that birth and death is a great matter and impermanence is swiftly passing. So like, keep the time well and go to Zazen. And and the ones hearing it also can remember that. It's kind of the words on the han maybe resonate out every time it's struck. Birth and death is the great matter, impermanence is swift. And Huineng said, well, why don't you realize that there is no birth and death and comprehend that there is no swiftness? And Yongjia said, realization itself has no birth. Comprehension basically has no swiftness. And Huineng, the sixth ancestor, said, right, right. That's so. He approved. And then Yongjia paid his formal respects with every courtesy. And then said, started to leave. And he said, well, isn't this a little too swift, actually? You just leave now? And they continue to talk some more and have their joyful Zen conversation. He said, oh, it's getting late. Why don't you just at least stay over one night and you can sit Zazen with us in the morning and then go. And so he agreed to do that. And therefore, he became called the overnight guest, Yongjia, meaning like, he only spent one night with the sixth ancestor, but completely received his teaching and is considered a disciple of the sixth ancestor and one of the great Chinese ancestors who express the Dharma through his song of verifying the way. And while I was thinking of this, I recalled one time that many years ago at Green Dragon Temple, there was a group question and answer ceremony with Venerable Teacher Tenshin, where people could come up and ask a question and he would respond. And I remember Monk Kokyo walked up to Venerable Tenshin and walked around his seat once and stood there in front of him. And Tenshin said, this is an ancient symbol. And Kokyo said, what does it mean? And Tenshin said, it means that you and I are one. And Kokyo said, are you and I one? Tenshin said, "No." Kokyo bowed and withdrew. Which has some similar flavor, I think, to this story. Especially that last line from Venerable Tenshin. This was all happening very quickly, right? But maybe there was some hope in the back of Kokyo's mind that the teacher would say, "Of course you and I are one. Come into my arms, child." And instead he said, "No." This was quite a while ago, but somehow it stayed with me, and I just remembered it today. And I remember that, vaguely remember this moment of, can I leave it at no and bow, instead of saying, "What do you mean?" And I am, is my presentation able to be blown away by the wind and disintegrate? And how seriously do I take those words? Will I now stew over that? He really says we're not one? Maybe I have to go practice somewhere else now. Find another teacher. Because that's like the supreme disappointment. Or did I just take it as, this was a very spontaneous dialogue, right? And with something being pointed out, was there some exchange of words, but also of energy and a kind of dynamic presentation going on here too that was being picked up on from both sides and checked and tested, and very difficult without being able to stop and think about it or see how things went afterwards. I don't think we ever talked about it again in that case. But I have no regrets. I have no complaints at all that he said no. In fact, if he had just said yes and had left, I might not even remember the story.
Well, I say, isn't it kind of like not two, not one?
Yeah. And
kind of pointing to non-duality.
Yep.
Whichever.
Yeah, sometimes they talk about the sword that gives life and that kills life in Zen, which is this way to respond that sometimes affirming yes, correct, right. And in that from that point of view, it's like, what couldn't be right? And this, when we're expressing that side of things, in these, you know, Zen in a dialogue in the halls of Zen, what could not be right, actually? Every expression is just people being themselves and expressing something. Of course, to stand here and present yourself is completely right. What could be the slightest wrong with it? And then there's the sword that takes away life that's like, actually, nothing is right. In this realm, nothing is quite right. Everything is a little bit off, because the very fact that anything's happening at all is a little bit off. So that's this side of negation. So we have the conventional truth of arising, where ultimately in the world of dependent arising, everything is right. Everything is included. It's the realm of vast interconnectedness. Nothing's missing. Nothing's extra. And then we have the realm of the ultimate truth, where nothing is happening. The realm of the Heart Sutra, where There are no eyes and no ears and no nose, no tongue, no body and no mind. And then the other side of the Heart Sutra is form itself is emptiness. So it can apply that to eyes themselves are emptiness. Not that no eyes are emptiness. Later the sutra says, in emptiness there's no eyes. But if form itself is emptiness, eyes themselves are emptiness. And everything is, therefore everything is right. But since actually in emptiness there's no eyes and no ears, anything is wrong. And then this issue of, like, I think, of course, in Zen, it's a very personal matter of understanding. We have to, nobody can give this to us, right? Nobody can give us understanding. We have to completely be one with our experience. And we can receive instructions how to do that, but we have to just wholeheartedly sit and thus drop away body and mind. And confirm for ourselves. And yet then there's this kind of sticky issue, at least in the Zen tradition, of this confirmation or meeting another. So Dogen Zenji has this whole Shobo Genzo essay called Self-Verification Samadhi. Self-approval samadhi, you could translate it as. Kaz says self-realization samadhi. But really this character means like to verify, confirm, or approve. Self-approval samadhi. And it's quite a dynamic topic, which we can't go into the whole thing. But just this came to mind too around this issue. So Dogen says some things like this. To experience yourself with the body and to experience others with the body is the great road of Buddhas and ancestors. Like, with your body and mind, we might say. Just turn the study of your beginner's mind and study simultaneously with others' beginner's mind. When self and others study together with the beginner's mind, you arrive together at the ultimate realm. In this way, your own endeavor encourages the endeavor of others. However, hearing the words self-confirmation, self-approval, and self-enlightenment, foolish people think that this is to receive transmission without a teacher and that one only needs to study by oneself. This is a great mistake. Those who make a crooked interpretation of self-approval, self-verification, without receiving instructions from a teacher are the same as those outside the way in India who believed in spontaneous enlightenment. So here's this issue again. How can they be considered practitioners of the Buddha way? And then Dogen gets into this long story about Zonggao or Da Wei, who had a determination to receive a document of heritage, which is like a kind of like the transmission document. He kept asking Da Wei to transmit a document of heritage to him, but Da Wei would not do so. He said, "If you want to receive transmission of Dharma, you should endeavor wholeheartedly and not be hasty. Buddhas and ancestors have not received and transmitted Dharma groundlessly. It's not that I spare transmission, but that you do not yet have the eye." Zonggao said, "The true eye one originally has is self-verification, self-enlightenment. How is it possible to transmit Dharma groundlessly?" Dao Wei just smiled and was silent. Kind of like, we're, okay. And you can read the long dialogues that continue about this issue of somebody who understands something, quite deeply and is trying to do this meeting thing also. I think it's... something very subtle and challenging and quite hard to talk about even, I think, here. So, that venerable teacher Tenjin has some comments on this story of case 16, Magu shaking his staff. And I thought these are quite wonderful comments. He says, here's a little outline of Zen practice. First settle, then bloom, then meet. Three steps of Zen practice. Settle, bloom, and meet. Settle. Settle into our experience moment by moment, settling to breathing, posture, conflicted emotions, opinions, judgments, and all that's happening moment by moment. This is to die into the moment, to let go of any other agenda other than simply being ourselves, to settle the self into the self, surrender completely to our experience. When we do this, then we just do this, and our life blooms. The theory of Zen practice is that if you can just let yourself settle completely into this dream body-mind, a spring flower will bloom up out of the ground. Once the blooming happens, and you don't necessarily notice it, he says, this flower should be brought to meet another flower. The flower which blooms from completely modeling ourself on ourself should meet another who has hopefully been doing the same thing, a companion. We come and we meet. I also propose that the Zen teaching is that only when two flowers meet do the flowers completely understand their nature. And a little bit more about this is that settling is voluntary and something you can make an effort at, like Zazen practice. Yeah. It's your personal responsibility as a Zen yogi, as a bodhisattva yogi. The next part is to bloom, and this is something that's a gift to you, so it's not your responsibility. It comes to you spontaneously. It's given to one who sits upright in the midst of her experience. The bloom is there in seed form even before you settle, but somehow, unless you're settling, you don't necessarily witness this seed. And not witnessing, or I would add in, confirming or verifying, self-approving of this seed. Blooming, if you don't verify the seed blooming, then you go to meet as a poverty-stricken person when you meet. So you need to meet as a worthy guest. And this meeting is half voluntary and half involuntary. You make an effort to go forth, but you can't make the meeting all by yourself. There has to be somebody else who's willing to come forth. That's a nice little description of Zen, which sometimes he also used to call like something like interpsychic and intrapsychic. In other words, it's like it's your mind and this meeting, it's your mind meeting another mind. If you hold back completely, exercising your ordinariness, you still believe your ordinariness. That's a great one. So, that's a great Zazen instruction, a great life instruction, I think, is can we stand to be like totally ordinary? And if we hold back a little on ordinariness, might mean something like, I would just like to be like slightly special. And it maybe also has to do with this approval issue. I want a little approval for being something a little more than ordinary. You know?
What's that saying? Sentence again?
if you hold back from completely exercising your ordinariness, you still believe your ordinariness. I think that's another part now, right? If we hold back from the, like, I can't quite stand to be ordinary, like, maybe I actually am, like, a little special, right? At that time, we're reifying or believing in the ordinariness, especially as a kind of a lousy second-class state of being. Whereas if we're not really believing it, especially as this kind of second-class state, then we don't hold back from it. We can totally settle into the ordinariness, which is quite extraordinary. He doesn't say that. And excuse me for saying so. You resist being completely ordinary because you think ordinary is real and you don't want to be ordinary. Those who are unwilling to be ordinary are trying to bloom in mid-air. If you're willing to get to the bottom of your ordinariness, you will get a great gift. At the bottom of your confusion, there's not anything but complete freedom. At the bottom of your ordinariness, you see that your ordinariness is illusory and empty, which saves you from ordinariness. But that's not enough. That is your realization, your confirmation, enlightenment. But to complete that realization, you have to meet somebody else in that realization. In other words, two completely ordinary, or multiple completely ordinary people meeting in complete ordinariness, which is hard to do, especially in like a form. Like these stories, you know, this story involved this kind of form of somebody sitting on a Zen seat and bringing in a staff and walking around the seat. And, you know, in our Dokusan practice, we have like forms for it. It's maybe hard, because the forms seem a little bit extraordinary and exotic, it's maybe harder to meet in the ordinary. Or to kind of downplay the exoticness of it, maybe we over-exaggerate the ordinariness of it, right? And say, kind of just joke around, kind of make fun of the forms, maybe, a little bit. You know, I might do this sometimes, you might do this sometimes, you know. Oh, sorry, you know, so often people in Dokusan, because there's a form and we don't do it that often, people say, oh, I forgot where to bow. Is that, bow like that. It's almost like kind of like, maybe like instead of just completely embodying the forgotten form, like bowing in the opposite direction, just to formally express something without any words. One says, is this okay? And in a way, that's actually perfectly right too. You know, it's all right. But what is it to meet in complete ordinariness without holding back from ordinariness or exaggerating ordinariness? You go to someone who you recognize is willing to be an ordinary person, Tenzin Roshi says. That's a difficult situation, to find someone you think is willing to be ordinary. We need to find such a person. Ordinary, confusion, ignorance, these are synonyms. This is the kind of ordinary we're talking about, just to be clear. Any phenomenal state of mind is ignorance. While still being an ordinary person all the time, I want to be ready to meet people like this. I want to meet somebody who wants to admit who they are, and I will try to admit who I am, and then maybe two people who can admit who they are can dare to meet each other. It's very embarrassing, the whole thing, he says. Wonderfully embarrassing, right? To be so ordinary. It's even excruciating, maybe. So part of Zen practice for the early years is just someone encouraging you to be yourself. When you can be yourself, then they can say, now bring that self forward and show it to me. Now see if you can stand there as I come forth and without rejecting me, be yourself. then for somebody to say, I see you there being yourself in the face of me being myself, each person standing in their true position. And then he goes into more dangers that happen at that point, of like veering away from ordinariness. And maybe these same principles and these dynamic Zen stories are actually play out in very ordinary circumstances outside of Dokusan rooms and Zen ceremonies. Every time we meet someone, especially in this realm of like looking for approval or being asked for approval, which I think happens all the time, you know, like at work and school and all through our day. Yeah. Is this okay? Is this all right? You're all right. Or actually, can I say something? Even though you're all right, that's actually not all right. Since right and wrong have no master, in one sense, everything is right. And in a certain spaciousness of big view, everything is in the end all right. And from the point of view of not all right, really, nothing is quite right. Or you can almost say, the definition of samsara, it's a cycle of suffering. I might even define it as the realm where everything is not quite right. Even when like things are going super well and we're having like an amazing time, something's still not quite right. There's still like somebody having a great time. Or there's still a great time. Or there's still a time. Or there is. Yeah, so this is getting down to the bottom of samsara. Everything is like a little bit off. I heard one teacher once, really struck me, like he was trying to make, I think, this kind of point, and said, what we're talking about here is like, he held up a pencil and he said, if you really like see very, very clearly how experience works, you'll see that this pencil is excruciating suffering. I thought, yeah. I mean, usually we don't, right? Pencil's fine. Unless then the tip breaks, and then it's a little annoying. But the more we're really settled in our experience, it starts to maybe become more and more clear that everything is a little bit off. But then there's the teaching that samsara and nirvana, which is the perfect freedom from samsara, are completely inseparable. So in this excruciatingly suffering pencil, it's perfectly all right. It's like completely free at the very same time. And it's a tightrope. A razor's edge that we walk on, called this life, or being ordinary, is like walking on a razor's edge. Is it completely off, or is it completely all right? Anything coming up you want to bring up? Yes.
I'd like to go back to the story of Monk Kokyo and Venerable Teacher Tenshin. I was struck by how you said, could you just be okay with the no? Because I think that so often, you know, we want to keep that approval seeking. I think sometimes it's like, you know, we want to be understood. We want our perspective to be validated.
Yeah.
And especially I'm thinking in long-term relationships that we have, you know, whether it's with a sibling or a romantic partner or a friend, anybody that you just are committed to a child, like as a parent, being with over time, how much we can tend to want to have them understand our story and validate our story.
Yeah.
And we keep, some of us try to persist until we get that. you understand, right? You get it, right? And then somehow we feel better when they go, yeah, I do, I get it. But what about those relationships when, you know, there's something like that? There's this, you know, in the dynamic of your relationship with him, there was just this turning that he
yeah.
had with you as teacher, student.
Yeah.
And to just accept it and not judge it and not like in a fatalistic way.
And
not like what was right and what was wrong. And maybe it, over time, sometimes conversations continue.
They often do.
Later, right?
And every relationship is different, too. And I think something about the nature of where I was at in that relationship at that time helped me to actually receive that quite fully because of the closeness of our relationship. And he might not have said that if it wasn't for our relationship being as it was. And in just, you know, other intimate relationships, I can recall times around this issue you're talking about that is very challenging, where you mentioned like being understood. So I think there's sometimes a case where I feel like somebody's wanting my approval, and it's more like there's this place in between where it's like, I actually do, after we go back and forth for a while, I actually feel like I really do understand you now. It's not that you're not understood. I really understand you. And I just personally don't agree. And I think that's different from like, I actually don't even want to, I don't understand you, and I don't even want to put in an effort. I don't really care. It's a little different. But like, I really understand where you're coming from and how you could be thinking that according to your conditions. And yet, I'm not that way. And is that okay? And sometimes if it's clear that that's how it is in an intimate relationship, sometimes it is really okay. Some may be a little painful, but I think the main thing is being understood. That's when it's really not okay. It's like, I really feel not understood, but no, I really understand. I could even like explain why I think that you think the way you do. And still, my conditioning is different.
But even there, there can be a bigger dimension to the relationship that could even hold not being understood.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And accepting that.
Yeah.
And not turning away from the relationship.
In yeah.
fact, including to continuing to view it as very intimate.
Yeah.
And just holding. It's like paradox.
Yeah. Partly because it's very intimate, and sometimes if we always agree on everything, actually it's not that intimate, I would say. For the depth of intimacy, I think there has to be some disagreement. Even in Zen, we have this phrases like the teacher, the student has to like stand on the shoulders of their teacher, or the student has to go beyond the teacher, otherwise the lineage dies. So that's like, means, we could take that to mean you have to disagree with the teacher, actually, in some way. And this is, again, a very dynamic thing, because if you disagree too much, then also the lineage dies. Yes?
Continuing from what you and Kathy have just been saying, if we used words like meeting and being met, would that suggest the larger context that Kathy was bringing up, where there isn't necessarily approval, but there is meeting in perhaps only a moment?
Yes. Nice point. Yeah. Yeah, the meeting doesn't have to be an agreement. And I think that's what a lot of these Zen stories, including this one, are about. Even wrong is a complete meeting. And we can also hear, wrong as not necessarily a disapproval, right? But maybe Magu falls into that when he said, "Well, Zhang Jing, the last teacher said right. Why do you say wrong?" That sounds like I'm getting emotionally involved. Yes. And Nanchuan said, "Zhang Jing is right." By saying that you're right, actually, we're just playing with words here. But now that you have this issue about it, you're wrong. And this doesn't say what this is, but this commentators bring up various possibilities. This is something that can be blown by the power of the wind, or that is whirled about by the power of the wind. It inevitably disintegrates, meaning like your involvement in right and wrong is being blown about by the winds of right and wrong, and praise and blame, and gain and loss, and praise and fame and disgrace. Or we could hear it as one of the ancient commentators actually says, it's more subtle than that. It's actually, this is you actually presenting yourself so wholeheartedly in a perfect expression of, I alone am the world honored one, to stand there and shake your staff and stand before the seat, nothing lacking, nothing extra. But that itself, actually, even that, it will disintegrate. In other words, your body and this moment and everything we think about Zen, all of this is like all just stuff of the appearing world, all being just blown away by the roaring wind of emptiness, and just all is just going to disintegrate anyway. So however confidently you express yourself in the moment, it's all totally like shaky, unstable, falling apart, impermanence is another way to hear it. So therefore, there's no problem with that. That's just the nature of the appearing world, actually. Let's invent an elixir for eternal life and immortality, and where we can end impermanence. I don't think so. That sounds very extraordinary. But ordinary birth and death, impermanent change, swiftly passing, the great matter is beautifully right. It's right, just right. So, just to close with the verse celebrating the story, Tian Tong Hongzhi's verse. Right and wrong, watch out for the trap. Seeming to put down, seeming to approve. It's hard to tell which of these teachers is the elder brother, which is the younger brother, or which is correct and not. Conceding or approving, he adapts to the time. Denying, disapproving, what's so special? One shake of the metal staff, standing out all alone, three times around the seat, a leisurely romp. The whole community is all agitated. Right and wrong are born. It seems like they're seeing ghosts in withered skulls. ghosts are all right too. We like to feed them sometimes. And sometimes the empty skull is enough. May any windy merits and virtues blowing around today waft off into the autumn night sky, touch all suffering beings throughout space and time. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I